WJFF Jeffersonville, New York, W233AH Monticello, New York.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the housing crisis in the Hudson Valley and Catskills. Landlords have found ways to oust renters with the market surging. What will happen when the moratorium on evictions ends? We chat with journalist Roger Hannigan-Gilson from the River Newsroom. It's freezing. There's snow everywhere. So what to do this weekend? Go fishing. Ice fishing, that is. Contributor Jesse Spisato reports on White Lake's King of the Ice Fishing Contest. Broadway Baby is a children's book from Narrowsburg-based theater producer Russell Miller. There's an all-star reading tomorrow to benefit Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. We'll find out more. Plus, the latest news from the Sullivan County Legislature. And Janice Adams has a childhood memory during Black History Month. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. President Biden has signed a major disaster declaration for the state of Texas, and he says he hopes to travel there next week as long as he does not get in the way of winter storm recovery. The storm crippled the state's power grid. 78,000 customers remain without electricity today. The outages this week mean spoiled food, and Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports that Texas was already dealing with historic levels of hunger.
State-mandated power blackouts caused mass spoilage in refrigerators and broken water pipes across San Antonio this week. Now long lines are being met by empty grocery shelves. That means more people without food and water. To try and meet the need, the food bank is hosting 7 mass food distribution events across the city. Eric Cooper is the president of the San Antonio Food Bank.
To think of a family that's dealing with the virus at this moment and having these environmental conditions, it's overwhelming. It really is overwhelming.
The city water utility will host its own distribution events. For NPR News, I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
House Democrats have unveiled the details of the next coronavirus relief bill. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the White House has upped the pressure on Congress to pass its nearly $2 trillion relief plan, which includes another round of direct payments and additional aid for state and local governments.
The measure includes $1,400 relief checks for Americans making $75,000 per year or less. It also extends extra weekly unemployment benefits through the end of August and includes additional funding for vaccine distribution and testing. Another provision calls for the gradual increase of the federal minimum wage to $15 per hour, a clause that's received pushback from Republicans and some moderate Democrats. The Biden measure is likely to face some hurdles in the Senate and needs support from every Democrat to pass with a simple majority. The House is expected to vote on the legislation by the end of next week. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
2 pilots are dead after their training jet crashed near an Alabama airport yesterday evening. NPR's Amy Held reports one of the people killed was with the Japanese military.
Investigators are trying to figure out why the T-38 trainer jet came down around 5:30 p.m. local time in a wooded area outside an airport near Montgomery, Alabama. The aircraft was with the 50th Flying Training Squadron based in Mississippi, according to a spokesman. Japan's Air Self-Defense Force says a Japanese Air Force officer and a U.S. Air Force instructor died in the crash. Japanese media report the 20-something-year-old lieutenant was learning to be a fighter jet pilot. Columbus Air Force Base specializes in undergraduate pilot training. Amy Held, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News. In San Diego on Friday, the U.S. processed 25,000 asylum seekers of the more than 65,000 people who had been sent to Mexico under the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico program. Max Rivlin-Adler of member station KPBS reports that many asylum seekers are left out of the new reentry policy put forward by the Biden administration.
Margie Rosales has been sleeping outside at the border entry for the past 3 days. She fled Honduras 2 years ago because she was sexually assaulted after an extortion attempt. She desperately wants to claim asylum for herself and her 2-year-old daughter. She makes a living selling ice cream on the streets of Tijuana. She says she hopes the president opens his heart and helps them, those on the border, because they're sleeping outside and it's cold. but Rosales never had a chance to enroll and remain in Mexico before the pandemic, so she doesn't qualify to enter the U.S. under the new policy. For NPR News, I'm Max Rivlin Adler in Tijuana.
A court in Moscow has rejected an appeal of the nearly 3-year prison sentence handed to Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. But the court did shorten his sentence by 6 weeks today. The judge took into account the time Navalny spent under house arrest. Navalny was in court today appealing his sentence for violating the terms of his probation while he was recuperating in Germany from a poisoning that he blames on the Kremlin. Naomi Osaka is this year's Australian Open women's champion. She won the title today, beating American Jennifer Brady in the final 6-4, 6-3. The title is Osaka's second Australia Open crown and her fourth Grand Slam championship. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, working together with communities to break down barriers and prepare all people for success in their jobs and careers as employees or entrepreneurs. More online at Kauffman.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Sullivan County Legislature met on Thursday. Sullivan County Democrats Isabel Braverman was there and has an update on the Ethics Board, the Care Center, and the Visitors Association. Sullivan Catskill Visitors Association was back on the agenda after being tabled the last time. What's the latest with the SCVA contract negotiations?
Yeah, so it actually remained tabled. The legislators decided not to take any action on it on Thursday during their meeting. Some of the legislators did comment that they are in contract negotiations with the SCVA and that they're going well. And they also entered into an executive session to discuss the contract, but there was no action taken after that.
Does it sound like it's maybe a little less volatile situation?
Right. Yeah, it does seem that way. And, Legislature Chairman Rob Doherty brought up the resolution to terminate the contract, which, you know, sort of sparked a lot of backlash from people, especially people involved with the SCVA, such as their board members or business members. And at last month's meeting, they all showed up and gave public comments to advocate for the SCVA. It was sort of explained that the language of terminating the contract was just to start a 60-day clock in order to negotiate, which it appears that is what is happening. Negotiations are happening between the legislators and Sims Foster, who is the board chairman for the SCVA.
The other issue that's been at the forefront of the legislature is the care center. The county chose a leasing partner for the care center. Is that right? And who did they choose, and do you know why they chose them?
Yeah, so after a pretty lengthy process, about 8 months, they have settled on their decision, and they chose Infinite Care Management to come in and take over the lease of the care center, which, if people aren't aware, the care center is the county-owned nursing home, and they have been in the process of finding an outside company to manage the facility. So Infinite Care is based in Brooklyn. They are the operator of 18 nursing facilities in New York, across the state, and also in Florida. The legislators made their choice last week, and they didn't exactly say why Infinite Care was chosen. They just said that any of the companies that were in the running would have been a good choice. They said that they had visited multiple of the facilities from each company, and you know, they liked all of them. But ultimately, Infinite Care was the first choice for a majority of the legislators, 7 out of 9 of them. And now they will begin contract negotiations with the Care Center LDC.
There's a vocal group of community activists that have been involved with the Care Center, and they were opposed to one of the operators. How did they feel about Infinite Care? Was this the one they were opposed to, or did you get any feedback?
I did, and they actually were. They showed up to the meeting. The group that they were opposed to is the Grand Healthcare System. They've been coming to some of the previous meetings, really asking the legislators not to go with the Grand. They said that they had spoken with family members of some of the residents at other facilities and heard these, you know, sort of bad stories about the level of care at their facilities. That's what they said that they heard. And in terms of them choosing Infinite Care, they were happy with that decision. They thought that doing their own research into the company as well as the legislators' research showed that it's a good, you know, managed facility. I did speak with Lou Setrin, who is one of the people who has been part of this group coming to advocate for the care center. His mother is actually a resident at the care center, and he's also on the family council. He said that he is cautiously optimistic for this decision going forward, and he hopes that in the future there would be some more transparency in this whole process.
And the next step then is the Local Development Corporation will negotiate a contract with Infinite Care. Do we know what that timetable looks like?
You know, I'm actually not sure. I haven't heard anything yet. I know that the LDC met yesterday, but they, you know, have to go into executive session to discuss the contract.
Right. Well, we'll definitely be keeping up on that. Also in the care center news, the New York State Nurses Association commended the Sullivan County Legislature's choice. They issued a statement saying that Infinite Care is, quote, a company who is known for its work with seniors and known for its relationship with its employees, especially when it comes to safe staffing, end quote. The other thing that happened, I guess, the Ethics Board Chairman, John Kiefer, spoke at the meeting.
Yeah, so he spoke to the legislators about the ethics charge that was brought up against legislator Louis Alvarez. A special meeting was held a couple weeks ago in regards to that ethics charge, and during that meeting, the legislators voted to take no action against Alvarez, and there was some discussion among them about the County Ethics Board. And, you know, sort of questioning, well, who's on the board? What do they do? How do they come to these decisions? So the chairman of the board, John Kiefer, said that he was there to address some misconceptions, is what he called them. He said that he has a lot of experience working in, the HR department, so he felt that he and the other members of the ethics board were qualified and, you know, asked the legislators to be more aware of that and what they do. And that sort of sparked another conversation about the county's ethics law.
And what was that conversation?
Well, they're currently making some changes to the ethics law, but it was brought up that instead of having a county ethics board, if it should instead be deferred to the state. The state has, you know, its own ethics board that can review cases. And just to explain this a little further, this all came about from, like I said, the ethics complaint against legislator Alvarez. That complaint stems from a county employee filing the complaint saying that Alvarez had a aggressive interaction with this employee. And the ethics board did uphold that complaint, and they had recommended that Alvarez take anger management classes. That was sort of the outcome of it. But like I said, the legislators took no action on it, so that didn't end up happening.
And John Kiefer was there to, well, I guess he was upset because the lawmakers were kind of questioning the qualifications of the ethics board members after this ethics board finding against legislator Alvarez. What was his tone? What was it? What was he addressing there?
Yeah, he, you could tell that he was sort of upset with the legislators for bringing that into question. He gave his background, which was pretty extensive. And he also said that during this hearing that they held, none of the members from the ethics board were present. He said that he wasn't invited. So he said, you know, they didn't have the chance to really back themselves up and back up the decision that they ended up making. He did say that one member actually resigned because of this situation.
Did he also question whether or not they supported, fully supported the ethics board, and should they have an ethics board? And did they kick around the idea of abolishing the ethics board?
Yeah, they did. There was some discussion over that. No decision has really been made yet. They said they're going to look into it more. But there was the discussion about, you know, using the state ethics board instead of having their own county ethics board.
Always some drama at the Sullivan County Legislature meetings. Isabel Braverman was there covering it. Anything in the weekend edition of the Sullivan County Democrat we should talk about?
Yeah, you know, one of our top stories is about the Governor Andrew Cuomo nursing home scandal. That is a story by Matt Shortall. He really goes into detail about what happened and what's going to happen with this scandal with New York State nursing homes.
Reporter Isabel Braverman from the Sullivan County Democrat, thank you so much for that update on the legislature, and we will definitely stay in touch.
Great, thank you.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. When the pandemic hit New York State, they banned eviction. The state banned evictions, but the housing crisis got worse. Landlords have found ways to oust renters in the region with the market swelling. Roger Hannigan-Gilson is a Hudson Valley journalist, and he writes about the housing crisis in The River, the independent news outlet. He joins us now. Roger, good morning.
Good morning.
And so, you know, the eviction cases have been paused, not eliminated with this ban. But you're right that some landlords in the Hudson Valley are resorting to pressure tactics and illegal means to try to remove their tenants. What are they doing?
Yeah, well, there's kind of some classic corrupt landlord things going on. We've seen kind of instances and talked to people that were locked out of their apartments. That is, they're behind on rent. They're being kept in their places by the evictions moratorium. They come home one day and their locks have been changed. So there's that. There's also, we saw an instance in Poughkeepsie, actually, in Lucky Platt Apartments. It's in downtown Poughkeepsie. It's kind of in the center of everything, and it's in part of a neighborhood that, you know, there's interest. Is this area going to gentrify? Are people going to move here? Some investors bought the place right before the pandemic with these original plans. But what ended up happening is they took these inexpensive apartments, and when anyone's lease ran out on the apartments, they would simply not renew it. And that's really how people are kind of more displaced in this situation. We saw, you know, we didn't see legal evictions like being completed through the courts and the sheriff's deputies coming out. It was more of ways landlords kind of circumvented it. With Lucky Platt, they wouldn't renew the lease, and then they would offer the apartment back to the original residents once it was renovated, but it was, you know, hundreds of dollars more expensive and most couldn't afford it.
Yeah. And one of the community members, the community activists you talked to, say they're kind of, quote, inhumane tactics that some of these folks or these landlords are using, including calling Child Protective Services.
That's kind of a pretty dirty one. She said that was someone, it was a pro bono attorney with legal services of the Hudson Valley, but she said she saw an uptick of landlords calling, Child Protective Services. There's other stuff, too. There's some people were locked out. They were referred to as the self-help evictions, kind of sardonically. And then there's also instances of landlords raising rent on rent-controlled apartments, that is, that are subsidized to the Section 8 program, which they're able to do. It's a bit more difficult. But the effect it has, and we talked to one tenant that was going through this, is the part of his apartment that was subsidized had maxed out. So the amount he owed was more. So he was having to try to find a new place to stay.
So what's going to happen when this moratorium ends? People are still going to owe rent, and then they're at risk of being homeless.
Yeah, that's the that is the big question, because it runs out May 1st. There's been various iterations of the moratorium. Everyone we talked to said this one, which was signed into law December 28th and expires May 1st, is the strongest. But the problem is all these eviction cases are kind of, they're straining at the bit to go forward because so much money has been unpaid. And in some courts, the eviction cases, while not completed, have kind of edged forward over the last few months. There's been so many gaps between the different moratoria that cases were able to proceed, just not to the point of a legal eviction. So there's all these cases caught up in court in Poughkeepsie, upstate. It's so when the eviction moratorium ends, there is fear that there's just going to be a deluge of mass evictions across the Hudson Valley, unless some sort of other program, some federal help is received.
And there's a movement to cancel rent, right, and in the area. And there's hope that there'll be some relief in the next federal COVID-19 stimulus bill, which is currently being hashed out by Congress. What else is happening at the community level?
We've seen this over the last many months, New York waiting for federal aid for various things. And, I hope that does come. But there's kind of ways the community are going around it, both laudatory and maybe not. In Hudson, we saw essentially what were private buyouts. Tenants that were behind on the rent were offered a lump sum to just vacate the place, and then their past rent would be forgiven. I saw one instance where they were trying to, like in Poughkeepsie, to renovate the place and sell it for more. So they gave the tenant who was behind on rent a lump sum to move out, which is arguably good. But at the same time, that person did want to live in that community. We've also seen in Hudson, Spark of Hudson is overseeing these negotiations. So between 40 and 50 tenants will only have to pay 50% of their owed rent and have the rest forgiven. And that's a program up in Hudson that hopefully will help a lot of people out.
Yeah, and you in your article, you write about this as a crisis that was years in the making in the context of wealthy downstate residents taking an interest in the Hudson Valley and Catskills region and then driving up rents and then causing this flow. It's a really well-researched article. And also, kind of heartbreaking, and you mentioned a conversation that you had with one person who was offered that lump sum, and it's about, leaving their community.
Oh, yeah. I talked to a couple people that were offered those lump sums. I quoted somebody who was familiar with them. But, from those conversations, I gleaned that the person, they were relieved because they had this horrible debt hanging over their head. But they were, they wanted to live in Hudson. The pandemic and the economic outfall didn't allow it. So, I visited them in their new place, and they were happy that they didn't have a debt hanging over their head, but they were not happy where they were. They didn't want to be where they were right then.
Yeah. Well, it's a good article. Journalist Roger Hannigan-Gilson, in-depth article at therivernewsroom.com about the housing crisis in the Hudson Valley. Journalist Roger Hannigan-Gilson also is running the news site The Other Hudson Valley. Roger, thanks so much for your reporting, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
We'll be right back.
Radio Chatskill. We'll go fishing when we get back.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with our new local public affairs show, The Local Edition.
We're here to advocate for our counties and our residents, and we want vaccine supplies.
Community news for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
They are picking and choosing who they bring to the table.
Join us right after All Things Considered.
We recently improved on the health record, am I correct?
You are correct. We did move up one spot.
The Local Edition, weeknights at 6:30 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And for 30 years, the Sullivan County Conservation Club has presented the area's premier ice fishing contest, King of the Ice. It's taking place tomorrow in White Lake. WJFF's Jesse Spisato has more.
Winters in Sullivan County can be pretty long, especially during a year in which traveling to warmer, sunnier pastures to break up the cold is not really in the cards for most of us. One thing we can do is embrace the frigid winter weather and have fun while socially distancing. How, you might be wondering? By participating in the area's premier ice fishing contest, King of the Ice. It takes place this Sunday, February 21st at White Lake. To learn more about this event and its history, I spoke to Jay Mendels, Secretary of the Sullivan County Conservation Club, which organizes the event. Here's our conversation.
I was wondering if you could start by telling me a little bit about your own involvement in King of the Ice and how long you've been a part of it.
Sure. Well, the King of the Ice is actually one of the fundraising events that we do through the Sullivan County Conservation Club. So let me start by giving you a little bit of background on that. We're a private organization, but we are very community-minded. We raise money for scholarships. We send kids to DEC camp. We hold DEC and NRA education and safety classes through our club. We run a lot of youth programs through our club. But in order to do everything that we're doing, we need to hold a couple of fundraisers through the year. One of the biggest that we've done and one of the most anticipated is King of the Ice. That started back in the 80s. To try to bolster interest in ice fishing for our area. And we've gone to a couple different lakes in the past, but for recent history, we've been at White Lake. And this is, let's see, we've been holding it for, well, it's been well over 30 years now. And it's an event that's the biggest and the best in the area as far as ice fishing tournaments go.
That's awesome. And what was it like in the very beginning? I don't know if you were a part of it in the beginning or not, but do you know like how big it was when it very first started?
Oh, it predates me. But in years past, they used to get 500-600 people out on the ice. It used to be huge, tremendous. In recent years, we run between 300 and 400 people most years. And it's always an outdoor event, so it's always weather permitting.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Actually, I saw that you guys weren't able to do it last year. Is that right?
Right. Unsafe ice conditions. It was touch and go right up until the end. But unfortunately, unsafe ice conditions had to rule. There were a lot of people that were disappointed that they couldn't do it. Safety first. Always safety first.
Yeah, of course. Actually, I was kind of curious, like, how do you determine that kind of thing? Like, how cold does it need to be for this event to take place? Or,
well, it's not, it has nothing to do with the with how cold it is. It's how much ice is on the lake. So it's how cold it's been leading up to the event.
Okay.
An individual ice fisherman walking out on the lake only really needs 2 inches of ice to support their weight. 4 inches of ice should be able to support a snowmobile or a four-wheeler. Right now, we're probably 10, 12 inches of ice with the cold weather spell that we've had. Don't hold me to that. I haven't been out there personally to find out, but we are anticipating an update this weekend from our people that are out on the lake.
Oh, that's amazing. And this might be a dumb question, but how do you figure out like how thick the ice is? You have to go on it and measure it.
Yeah, there's only one way. You have to drill a hole.
Okay, so gotcha.
You get an ice auger, you drill a hole, and measure.
That's awesome. So I was wondering if more or less people signed up this year since it's the pandemic. Obviously, it's an outdoor activity, but, mm-hmm. you know,
Well, we, most of our people that register that day. We have a registration site set up at the lake where people are accessing the lake. They'll sign in and go out to the lake. We do have a pre-registration offer for people. It gives them a $3 discount off of the registration price. But usually we only get about 10 to 15% of the people pre-register. Most wait until that day.
Oh, that's so funny. That's amazing.
Yeah, and right now we are well over average for the number of pre-registrations. I haven't gotten an update in a few days, but at this point in years past, we're way ahead. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with the pandemic, that people are really looking forward to getting out, to doing things outdoors. Anytime we put a post on Facebook about the event, it gets a tremendous amount of attention.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that. Yeah, I was kind of wondering, like, how easy is it to socially distance on the ice? Like, you know, it's a big lake, obviously, but I don't know if people are sort of, like, in one area or...
No, they have the whole lake. Now, White Lake is actually White Lake and Kaneanga Lake. The two of them form one lake. So our event takes into account the entire area. The lake itself is over 280 acres big. I think there's over 4 miles of shoreline.
Oh, wow.
It's a big lake. You can put 300 to 500 people on there, and no one needs to be on top of each other.
Wow, that's great. That sounds so fun. Can you walk me through what the day is like? Like, the contest begins at 6 a.m. How long do they have to catch the biggest fish?
Okay. Our registration trailer opens up at 5 a.m. And wow. At 5 a.m., there is always a line of people. Waiting in the dark to sign up. As soon as they sign in, everybody gets a little badge. It's a little button with this year's logo on it. And that way we know that they've registered. As soon as they get that button, they can grab their gear and head out onto the ice, to get set up. They can, claim their space, set up camp, and drill their holes. There's absolutely no fishing to be done before the event starts at 6 a.m.
Gotcha.
And if they do, and we'll be watching, you'll be disqualified from the contest for the rest of the day.
Okay.
So starting at 6 a.m., the lines go in the water, and anything that comes out between 6 a.m. and 3 p.m. that's worthy is brought to the Weighmaster station to be weighed and measured.
Wow.
One thing to point out, just so that people don't think that they can fish a week ahead of time and keep something in their freezer, the fish needs to be brought to the Weighmaster station alive to be counted.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah, that's a good... You can't just buy it at the store.
Right, or catch it the week before and keep it in the freezer. Yeah, we don't want that. So bring it in alive, get it weighed, get it registered, and then go back to fishing.
How many fish usually end up making it to the Weighmaster station? Do you have any idea?
We encourage them to bring most of them to the Weighmaster station. We have... well, first of all, there's several species of fish that you can bring in. We have the eligible species are trout, walleye, pickerel, crappie, and perch.
Okay.
So you can bring any of those to the Weighmaster station. We give out, for adults, we give out cash prizes for first place in each of those categories. And for kids, we give out trophies, first, second, and third, for each of those categories.
Oh, cute.
So, again, we encourage most people to bring in their catch so that they can be registered and displayed. And the biggest fish, the biggest tally overall, is eligible for a $500 prize.
That's a really great prize.
Yeah. And you get to wear the crown and get your picture taken as the king of the ice or queen of the ice. We had a queen a couple of years ago.
Oh, I was going to ask that, actually. Yeah. Are there a lot of females that participate as well?
There's a lot of families that participate. You'll see a lot of couples, a lot of family units, a lot of kids out there.
That's cool.
We do. It is free registration for all kids 15 and under, as long as they go out with a paid adult. So we do tend to get the kids out there, which ultimately is our goal. We want to see this sport continue for the next generation, and we have to maintain interest in it. The way to do that is to get the kids out there.
Totally. Are you an ice fisherman yourself, I assume?
It's been years since I've been out, especially being involved with the club. I tend to be more on the administrative side than the actual participant side.
Totally. How big was the biggest fish that you've ever seen someone catch since you've been involved?
Well, out of the last couple of years, 3 events ago, one of our participants, his name was Paul Felisky. He caught a 10-pound walleye in the lake. It measured 29 and a half inches. That was probably one of the biggest for our contest over the last few years.
Yeah.
But we've seen bigger. And in fact, last year we were canceled, but in 2019, our winner was a 5-pound pickerel caught by Rob Ward. He was our king of the ice that year. But a couple of days later, one of the participants was back out on White Lake and ended up pulling in a 10-pound trout.
Wow.
So they were sure to send us a picture of that. they were a couple days late for the tournament to win the prize, but it was still nice to see that come out of the lake.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. I only see little fish when I look in like any of these lakes.
Well, the White Lake is 85 feet deep in spots, so I don't think that you'll be able to see where the big ones are.
Wow, totally. That's impressive. Do you have any crazy or memorable stories from past contests?
Oh, that's a good question. Nothing that really comes to mind, except to see the joy on little kids' faces when they come to the Waymaster station with whatever they're carrying. Just the fact that they're participating, it's wonderful. If you have the chance to look on our website, I've tried to put up some pictures, especially of the families and of kids that have participated over the years. And it's always nice to see the smiles of the kids, because you know they're going to be future fishermen and perhaps future king or queens of the ice.
Oh, that's so awesome. Yeah, I'm definitely going to take a look. My daughter, who you just met, who's very small, obviously, but she has a little like fake tackle box already.
Oh, good.
Yeah, well, good. She really likes playing with it.
Breaking her in the right way.
Yeah.
It's too easy for kids, especially in this pandemic, to not enjoy the outdoors. So it's nice to see, and I think it's important that we get as many out there as we can.
Totally. I totally agree. What would you say to someone who's interested in ice fishing but has never done it before? Like, do you need a hut to go out there? Do you need electronics? Do most people have all that stuff?
Ice fishermen are a friendly bunch. We encourage spectators. We get inquiries about this every year. People are saying, I've never done this before. I want to introduce my child to it. Do I need to register? Do I need to have all the equipment? Not necessarily. We get a lot of people that come out just to spectate, just to walk. You know, if it's a nice day, walk around on the ice, talk to some of the people that are out there. I've known many people personally that are more than happy to set up a hole for a little kid to just to sit there with a jigging rod. To get the experience of fishing. If you are going to be there as a contestant, then yes, you would need your own equipment, something to drill the holes. Ice tents are a nice feature. They're not required, but it's a nice way of keeping out of the elements and still being able to stay outside on the ice.
Yeah, I mean, especially because you're out all day long. So, well, this has been really great to chat. Is there anything else that we didn't get to that you wanted to talk about?
I would like to say, I would just like to thank the White Lake Fire Company for their involvement with us on this project. The registration site is set up behind their firehouse on White Lake, and we use their pavilion area kind of as our go-to point. The fire department will be out there. They'll be serving refreshments through the day, and they'll be hosting a warming station for our participants. But having access to the lake through their facility certainly makes things easier for us, and we're happy to support them in any way that we can. So we'll be out there from 5 a.m. that morning, and that's on February 21st. We do have a bait vendor lined up to sell bait on the ice for our contestants that don't bring their own. And we'd like to welcome all WJFF listeners to come out and join us that day. It's a fun day out on the ice, and the Conservation Club looks forward to hosting this event every year.
Awesome. That's so great. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me. I'm looking forward to getting out there, seeing you on the ice.
Oh, it's been my pleasure talking to you, Jesse. Thank you for your interest in our event, and look forward to seeing you out there.
The event takes place this Sunday, February 21st at White Lake. You can register in person at the White Lake Fire Department starting at 5 a.m. For more information, check out the Conservation Club's website at SullivanCountyConservationClub.org. See you out there on the hard water!
And the forecast calls for mostly sunny skies and temperatures warming up to 31 in the afternoon. This is Radio Chatskill. When we come back, we'll learn more about the Broadway Baby. We'll be right back.
This Week in This American Life, one of our producers here at the show, Susan Burton, recently revealed a secret that she had kept to herself for decades from everybody in her life. And I do mean everybody. Nobody knew it all. Not her family, not a single friend, nobody. And it got her thinking about secrets. Why we finally tell them, if we do finally tell them. Stories she found in other people's lives. All about that this week.
This American Life, Saturday evening at 6.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The children's book Broadway Baby follows the journey of a young New York City dreamer who was born to entertain, from the crib to the playground to the stage. A star-studded online reading of the book, written by theater operator and producer Russell Miller, will be hosted by One Grand Books tomorrow at 3 to benefit Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. Miller, based in Narrowsburg, has produced such blockbusters as Guys and Dolls, Blood Brothers, and On the Town, but he'd never written a book before.
This was all a little bit random in that respect. It actually happened. My producing partner at Freedom Theatricals is he's a three-time Tony Award winner, and he and his wife had a beautiful baby, Olivia, a year and a half or so ago. And I was looking for a gift for them for that celebration of her birth, and I knew exactly what I wanted to get, which was a very theatrical book, being a very theatrical family. And I just couldn't find anything, really, not anything that was sort of true and authentic to the theatre world that I've certainly been in for too many years now, 20 something odd years. And Corey, my partner, you know, longer than me, really, and specifically Broadway. So it was really important that it was the right thing, and it needed to be authentic, as I say, and true to the spirit of Broadway and theatre, really. So having not found it, I decided I'd put pen to paper and started to wade through it, and got that together. And about 3 weeks after sort of finalizing writing it, I'd managed to get this this publishing deal, which was amazing, really, and quite an unexpected and wonderful journey, start to finish, to be honest.
That's kind of amazing in the publishing world to get something so fast, right?
Shocking, actually, but wonderful at the same time. And the publisher that I'm working with, Meteor Books, we work with them on some other things in terms of documentaries and what have you. So it was really great that it was embraced in the way in the way that it was. And you know, I feel that I've been very lucky in terms of my my writing partner on this, Judith Proffer. Excuse me, Judith Proffer is a big theatre fan. And she and I sort of really got our heads together, me sort of having operated theatres in the West End and on Broadway and now producing shows, and her being such a massive theatre fan. We really found that the sort of the composite of my professional experience and her fan experience really sort of made sparks fly in terms of creating something, not just from the verse, but also visually, that really spoke to what we know and what we love, and I think it's really worked. And the reviews are in. We're a bestseller on Playbill, so it's a wonderful, it really has been a wonderful journey, and especially throughout COVID, which, you know, it isn't a COVID book. It was born pre-COVID, but having gone through all of that, you know, at this time, it's certainly been a helpful tonic to be able to concentrate on something that's sort of so warm and happy. And to put that out there, and to, you know, to start to see children reading it and enjoying it and smiles on their faces, and parents being happy that they have this thing to introduce to children at a time when there's no theatre to be introduced to in a live sense anyway.
Introduce us to the character, the Broadway baby in the book. He's a baby. Tell us about the plot of the book.
He is. So, I mean, it's really intended to be something that children can look at any age, whoever they are, and just be able to imagine themselves having a path to Broadway, really, and experiencing being on stage. And I think the book itself is about, you know, giving people, children, confidence and the ability to dream big. And that really is the story. It's a dream of a baby in a crib that starts with thinking about how amazing it would be to be on Broadway, and then how those dreams sort of progress and then gradually works through all the different areas and aspects of the theatre that you know, we know and love, and some see more than others, particularly in terms of the props room and the wardrobe and backstage. So it's a little bit of a kind of a behind sneak peek, behind the curtain VIP access, if you like, as well. But it's an important thing for me to have included all of this, because I feel that it's important that theatre is made more accessible. And I think this is an important first step of a series of books that we're looking at the moment to really do that and more. And hopefully, you know, as you read that, you really get all of the feels that come with that in terms of, you know, the invite and the inclusivity and the accessibility to what's a really, you know, wonderful world of theater.
Broadway baby might have legs. He might
little legs.
It's a beautifully illustrated book too. Can you tell us about the artist behind the illustrations?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, I think that the illustrations really sing. And Yoko Matsuoka is the illustrator who's based out in Japan. She's done a lot of work with the publisher. But there was no question, you know, once the treatments came in of how a baby might look and what the feel of that was like, Judy and I were both absolutely clear that that was our illustrator. So she got to work and really sort of set our vision onto the page. And then we were extremely fortunate. Spencer Proffer, who is the voice of Meteor 17 books, is very, very connected into the music industry. And he brought together the design aspect with a chap called Hugh Syme, who is an amazing graphic designer, has done a lot of the graphic design for some of the big album covers for Aerosmith and Whitesnake, and did all of the Rush album covers. So really, you know, entertainment centric, which we thought was important. And he got to work on Yoko's original illustrations and just kind of kicked them up a notch, really, with the graphic design that he put together. So, you know, from the Broadway baby logo, as it were, the header on the cover, to some of the really sort of funky little touches that are in the book that are clearly more graphic design than illustration. So it's a really, you know, it's a 9x12 book. It's a beautiful quality book, and it's a big book to hold, so we really feel that, you know, those images really stand out. And it's that sort of thing you can imagine, sort of, you know, being able to sit down with your children and you know, read a fun story with a really good sized book to enjoy all together as a family. It's quite wonderful. I'm so proud of it.
Now, you've called on your friends in Broadway. You've got a star-studded online reading of the book hosted by our friends at One Grand Books tomorrow at 3 p.m. And it benefits Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS. Can you tell us about some of the folks that are participating and how that came about?
Goodness, yes. Well, we've been absolutely blessed, really, really blessed. I mean, we have a number of 13, I believe, readers in all. We've got Tony winners, people like Santino Fontana, who was played Tootsie, won a Tony for Best Lead in Tootsie. And nominees, Laura Osnes, Caitlin Kinnunen, both Tony Award nominees. Sort of headlined, if you like, by Gloria Estefan, three-time Grammy Award winner.
Oh, wow.
And Kevin Spiritus, three-time Emmy Award winner and Tony winner. So there's a real array. I'm sure I've probably missed others, but they're all beautifully talented, real Broadway-centric people and television and music. And it's just a blessing, because to see the words sort of come to life as they breathe you know, their words to them is just so special, and it really shows you how good they are at what they do, because they get it as well. You know, it is all very theatrical. So to see them all read and the sort of the mashup of all the different readings from everybody that's there has been wonderful to watch. It really has. And it's so fun and engaging. And I think children will really, really love it, as will parents as well. I mean, I haven't stopped watching it since the edits keep coming in. And Aaron over at One Grand is just fabulous. And he's so passionate about all of this, as he is, you know, with the store there. So it's a thrill to be able to help support independent bookstores, as well as Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS, which at the moment, obviously for the theatre industry, which is pretty much on its knees across the world, certainly Broadway and the West End, which are the sort of the two, obviously two more well-known frames for professional theatre, are just, you know, they haven't been in operation since March of last year, as many other businesses are, don't get me wrong, but to be able to support that with all of the sales of the books and what Aaron is doing with this event is really, really special. And I'm extremely grateful to not just Aaron, but to the readers for giving their time up to make that happen for the book, but to really help Broadway Cares with the great work that they do, because they raise so much money for all some really great theatrically and non-theatrically, but theatrically based charities largely. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. So it's a thrill.
Yeah. You have over 25 years of experience running theaters and entertainment venues, and also you mentioned in London and in the States and on Broadway. What's this been like for you as a producer in that area that you love and write about in your book, but not being able to participate in that live interaction?
Oh, Tim, it's brutal. It's so brutal. I mean, Freedom Theatricals, my company, is relatively new off the mark, really, albeit we're sort of quite old and long in the tooth now in theatrical terms, but as a new production company, it's relatively new. And so we had a lot of productions that were about to go into workshop, and we've been cultivating a lot of music-centric you know, productions that we were working on. And so a lot of that has just had to sort of sit dormant, really, until we got to a position, or until we get to a position where we can start to mobilize those things again, which hopefully, you know, with the vaccine happening now, will be very soon. Having said that, we've also been, you know, incredibly fortunate that we were able to sort of pivot somewhat, actually before COVID, fortunately, in terms of looking at our model and how we wanted to create content. And we really felt, again, going back a little bit to making theatre more accessible, that we wanted to do, you know, very music-centric theatrical productions. And so with that and our relationship with Spencer Proffer, we've managed to sort of pivot and look at creating television documentaries and films that also can be adapted to the stage. So we have a few of those things happening. We're doing a wonderful documentary. It won't be adapted to the stage, but we're doing a documentary on Stephen Schwartz, who wrote Wicked and Godspell and Pippin and all that good stuff. He's an absolute dream to work with, and we're really excited especially with Wicked the movie on the horizon now that we're working on that. So that's great. We're doing a big thing with Don McLean on American Pie as a documentary, and that will be a stage play as well. So it's, you know, there's enough that's been going on to keep us busy. It's just very sad that, you know, there's no theatre to enjoy and to be at the sort of the top of the list with, you know, what we have been doing and what is a part of our core business for so long. But we're confident it will come back. It really will. And, you know, theatre's been around since 400 BC. So I think we'll see ourselves through this. But it's just a very tough time to endure that. And, you know, our hearts go out to everybody working in the industry at the moment. And, you know, we can't wait to help mobilise things when we know that it's safe to do so, you know.
Right. Yeah. And well, it sounds like you're ready to go once we're allowed to gather in person like that.
We're trying.
In the meantime, we've got the reading of Broadway Baby, the book. That's tomorrow, hosted by One Grand Books. There's more information at broadwaybabybook.com. And also on Facebook and Instagram, like any good baby, he has his own account.
Right.
Russell Miller, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your Broadway Baby.
Thank you, Tim, so much. I really appreciate you fitting us in, and stay safe and warm over there.
We should mention that One Grand Books is a financial supporter of WJFF. February celebrates Black History, and Janice Adams, host of the Janice Adams Show on WJFF, shares a recollection from her childhood, a family road trip that traced the history of her heritage.
This little light of mine. Our family packed up the van and went off in search of adventure. We'd read stories of long ago courage, hope, determination, of men, women, children daring insurmountable obstacles. What we called history was there, live free or die. Distances that once took tortured weeks on foot took us 8 hours by car, and actually seemed a long time as we followed in the footsteps of the Underground Railroad. On a lonely road in the Ohio chill, we were tired, hungry, cramped from riding too long. It was dismal outside, wet and foggy. We were ready to complain. Then, driving a deep stretch of Ohio woods, a thought came that froze us mid-lane, mid-thought. Lonely groups of travelers, running, walking, hiding out for their very lives, had come this way before. They were cold, hungry, and wished nothing more than to be left alone. But slave catchers and yapping dogs drove them on. We'd known the story of a woman jumping from ice patch to breaking ice patch on the half-frozen Ohio River, afraid she'd drown if she kept on, terrified of what would happen if she didn't. But on her back she carried a precious bundle. That weight, the life of her child, made her light as rain as she slipped along the checkered route. It must have seemed to her the ancient parting of the waters, for as the ice broke behind her, it separated her from her would-be captors, from slavery. We thought of Eliza as we traveled on the road that night, and of the countless others whose courage knew no bounds or chains. Cold and worn, tired and hungry, we grew quiet, very grateful. This we knew. We could be where they'd been, travel the routes they'd traveled. We might even see some of what they had seen. But thanks to them, we would never live what they'd been forced to endure. The sky unsheathed its trail of stars, guiding us on a winding trail to our freedom, to rethink life's possibilities. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, I sang for my daughters, reviving voices of old. Looking in the rearview mirror, I could see them cuddled in the back seat, looking out at the stars. Everywhere we go, we're gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. We sang, renewed, pressing on. I'm Janice Adams.
A reminder to listen to the Janice Adams Show today at noon. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Remember to wear a mask, stop the spread, be kind. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Rourke Law, Liberty, New York, a general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., hand-picked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
WJFF, Jeffersonville, W233AH, Monticello.
The forecast for the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania today, variable clouds and snow, a high of 26.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Public radio for the Catskills and northeast Pennsylvania. Radio Catskill.